Micah chapter 4 today and jump back into the book of Micah here. I thought I would just take a moment here as you're finding it, just to remind you that we're not just doing Micah because it's a random book out of the Bible or because I wanted to spend some time in the Old Testament or even just necessarily spend some time in the prophets. Really, we're in Micah because it's been my intention ever since we kicked back off in the fall to just spend a little bit more time just thinking about again, talking about, and letting God's word remind us of what it means to be his people and what are the things we are called to together as a church, as his people. And I think it was Mark Kessler came into my office one day and we were talking about what we're going to be looking at in the fall. And I told him, you know, some more about the mission of the church. And he said, you know, it might be nice to also address some of the things in our own hearts that get in the way of a faithful participation in God's mission. And so that got me thinking actually about Jonah, right? I mean, can you get somebody who is a more living example of things in his own heart to get in the way of a faithful participation in the mission that God had called him to? Or Micah, you know, you can see him ranting against things that are going on in God's people. I say, wait a minute, this is what God has called us to. This isn't the mission that he's called us about. And Micah's probing around what's going on there. Why is this happening? And in particular, I'll just say this and we'll hit it. Jonah, I felt, you know, led us into some good healthy discussions on what it meant to take the redeeming, forgiving message of God to outsiders or people maybe that we're not exactly comfortable with, or maybe people that we don't necessarily naturally have a burden for, right? But that's part of the responsibility of the church, is to take God's redeeming work through Christ, his message, out. So we talked about that. And then I think Micah, he wants to talk more about some of the issues of, okay, and what does it mean to live as a faithful community? You know, he's going to keep using, harping on this word justice, and what does each individual of the community do, you know, by virtue of being created as God's special creation, by people created in his image, and, you know, how is God's people, or how is the church, called to pursue those issues, justice, injustice, and all that? So that's been part of the discussion. Again, just trying to remind us why we're spending time in Jonah and Micah. And yeah, that's enough of that. Let's dive into it. Why don't we stand together? We're going to read chapter 4 of Micah. We're going to read verse 1 through 8, but really, I'm really only going to be working through in the sermon time 1 through 5, but it all kind of fits together, 6, 7, 8, so we'll continue with that as well. Okay, so Micah chapter 4, beginning in verse 1 down through verse 8. It shall come to pass in the latter days that the mountain of the house of the Lord shall be established as the highest of the mountains, and it shall be lifted up above the hills, and people shall flow to it, and many nations shall come and say, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob, so that he may teach us his ways, and that we may walk in his paths. For out of Zion shall go forth the law and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. He shall judge between many peoples, and he shall decide for strong nations far away. And they shall beat their swords into plowshares, and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war any more. But they shall sit every man under his vine and under his fig tree, and no one shall make them afraid, for the mouth of the Lord of hosts has spoken. All the peoples walk each in the name of its God, but we will walk in the name of the Lord, our God, forever and ever. And in that day, declares the Lord, I will assemble the lame and gather those who have been driven away and those whom I have afflicted. And the lame I will make the remnant, and those who were cast off a strong nation. And the Lord will reign over them in Mount Zion from this time forth and forevermore. And you, O tower of the flock, hill of the daughter of Zion, to you shall it come. The former dominion shall come, kingship from the daughter of Jerusalem. This is the reading of God's word to us this morning. And we pray that he would give us eyes to see and ears to hear and hearts that are submitted to it in faith. I hope everybody had a great celebration of Christmas. and a nice new year. It's nice to be back in the pulpit here after a couple weeks. As part of the, over Christmas there, we took a little bit of time off, and during that time off, I got the privilege to be a chaplain at a teen winter weekend, sort of like what our teens are doing this week up at Snow Glow. But I was up in northern central Pennsylvania, up above Walnut, what's the Little League Hall of Fame town? Williamsport, there it is, not Walnutport, Williamsport, yeah. It was up in there in the mountains and the hills. Amy didn't get to go because one of the kids had a respiratory infection, so he had to stay back. So I got to take the girls, which I think they were excited about. Maybe not quite so excited because I was really excited to go because at long last I was going to get in some good hiking. All right, this is up a neat little camp, literally nestled inside a valley with pretty sizable mountains all around, and so I just wanted to drag the kids on some hiking ventures, which they did. They did very good at. The second day in particular was probably the highest of the mountains that we went after, and whereas the first day kind of whined and zigzagged back and forth, took a couple hours to get to the top, this one was pretty much a straight shot. Your goal was to get to the top in about 45 minutes. So it was one of those hikes where, you know, you're starting to huff and puff a little bit, your legs are burning, kids are looking a little tired. Okay, but we had been told at the bottom that, man, when you get to the top, the view is worth it. Right, you get up there, there's a little rocky overhang where you get to step out and you just get to see for miles, and you get to see the river that cut the valley down through all these hills and these mountains. And so that was sort of our inspiring vision, if you will, as we were trudging up through the woods, up along this mountain. It was like, well, can't wait till we get to the top. We're almost there. We'll be able to look out for the girls, have our snacks and our drinks and have a good time and just be, but yeah. And so, okay, we've talked here, I think numerous times, that in a way that's sort of what hope does, right? As you're trudging along through life, the joys, but then also the struggles and the challenges, it's an inspiring vision of hope that motivates you to keep going and also challenges you to faithfulness. I love seeing pictures of summer because I'm not so much of a winter guy. Even snow, take it or leave it. I often tell people second half of January into February are my dark times of the year. So whatever smiles you see on my face in February, they're half forced. So it's what gets me through. It's just pictures of summer, or it's pictures of our summer vacation, and maybe we're thinking about what we're going to be doing this summer, or maybe it's watching Ken Burns baseball documentaries to get me interested for spring training and all that fun stuff, right? That's what hope does. As we come into chapter 4 here, I think that's a little bit of Micah's intention, right? Micah wants to give us this striking vision of hope, right, that will inspire the people to press on and will, in particular, inspire them to increase faithfulness. All right, you remember Micah is writing to and on behalf of a group of people who are suffering pretty intensely. They have lost their land and their livelihood through very deceptive means, right? We've talked about that. And as they've come to the authorities and to the courts, or maybe even to the religious prophets, looking for someone to take up their cause, there's nobody to do it because they're all in bed with the oppressors. They've all been stuffed wads of money in their back pocket. So nobody's there to take up their cause. Nobody's there to defend them. And so Micah's here laying out this great vision of hope. Right, that one day God will be the judge, and one day God is going to judge faithfully all the nations, all the strong nations. I think he's also speaking here to some of those rulers and prophets and officials in the places of power that he has really railed against the past three chapters. You remember, I think it was Pastor Mark looked at this at the end of chapter 3. He says, because of you and what you have done, this city, Jerusalem, that you have built on lies and deceit, verse 12, chapter 3, it's going to be plowed as a field. It will become a heap of ruins. And the mountain of the house, or the mountain of God's temple, will become just a wooded height. Okay, but Let me hold some hope out there for you. That's not where this story is going to end. Yes, God is going to come in judgment, and yes, God is going to do that whole back to you, what you have done to his people thing. Okay, but that's not where the story is going to end. He holds out this great vision of hope for them. Right, and it's a really striking one too. I'm going to jump actually right into there. I'm going to continue in verse 3. He shall judge between many peoples and shall decide for strong nations far away. And then here he goes, and they shall then take their swords and beat them into plowshares. He's going to take their spears and refine them into pruning hooks. Right? All the people then are going to take their these instruments that they've used for violence and bloodshed. Instruments maybe that they have used to prop up their oppression and their discrimination or whatever they're doing. They're going to take those instruments and going to beat them down into these agricultural tools. Right, they're going to take these instruments that they have used to tear down and to destroy, and instead they're going to turn them into instruments to cultivate God's good creation and bear rich fruit from it that can be for, I don't know, the good of all mankind or the blessings of the people. And then not only that, but he keeps going, nations shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war anymore. Right, no longer and remember here, he's writing to a people who are staring down the Assyrian Empire. And they know that the Assyrian Empire is already kind of poking through northern Israel and laying waste to certain cities and is making its way down to Judah. Well, here's this captivating vision. Look, that one day, there's not going to be any war anymore. All the swords are going to be beaten down into plowshares, spears into the pruning hooks. Nations aren't going to be raising sword against another. And then not only that, but they won't even be able to learn war anymore. It's like war somehow is going to be stripped out of the consciousness of the nations and the people. It will no longer be the sort of the default mode or way of dealing with fear and insecurity or, you know, lust for land or whatever it is. It just won't be there. There'll be no more training centers or planning, you know, Pentagon type abilities. There'll be no more West Point or naval academies, right? Because they'll have no reason to learn war anymore. Or to continue with maybe a modern example, the Congress and governments will have to think of another way to take the near $750 billion that we spend annually on self-defense and take that and invest it, I don't know what, in infrastructure or in the general well-being of the people, right? This is a striking vision. Swords are beaten down, spears into pruning hooks and all that, and no more war. It's just not even in the consciousness. They will never learn of it anymore. I think sometimes you just kind of have to stop and kind of reimagine what that's going to be like. Right? We're a nation that's been at war for, what, 17 years now over in the Middle East, and we never even hear about it. It's not even a debate point anymore, you know, come election time. It's like we've just sort of accepted it. It's just the way it is, and we'll get out of it when we're out of it. It's good for us to just stop. And, oh, this is a striking picture that war won't be in the consciousness of the people throughout God's creation. A striking vision. Well, that's a compelling one, too. On a broader cultural level, even if you go up to the United Nations building in New York and you go to the North Garden, there's actually a statue there of a big guy with a massive hammer beating a sword into literally into a plowshare. Right? It's as if that's sort of the goal of what we're doing here, bringing nations together. It's ultimately to strive for this day when war won't be the answer to it. Which maybe leads it to the other point too, that statue. I always found that statue at the UN kind of ironic, or maybe ironic's not the term, but maybe it shows how not only is this a compelling vision of the future, but it's a vision that, okay, we can't help but notice it's just rather elusive, right? I mean, here you have it in the North Garden of the United Nations building. This whole effort to bring nations together so we can work out our differences around the table or talk it through, and so we don't have to use war as the solution. And yet violence, anger, aggression, war, it still seems so prevalent. Right? This vision of nations not raising up war anymore, not learning war, it just seems so very elusive. Which is why, then, you have, back it up now to verse 1 and 2. Here's the accompanying part of this vision. That in those latter days, the mountain of the house of the Lord shall be established as the highest of the mountains, and the people shall flow to it. Back in the ancient world, civilizations, they would put their temples to their gods. They would put them up on high hills. They would do it for a variety of reasons. Higher hills have higher visibility, so all the people could look, see the temple, be reminded that God, their God, is there present with them in their midst. It was also considered to be sort of like an ascent or a stairway into heaven. Cue the music. Mike, I know you can play that, right? But think of like the old ancient Aztec temples, right? Where it's literally the temple is almost in the shape of a staircase, right? Because you're ascending up into heaven. Okay, but the other reason they were put on the high place is it was a symbolic gesture. You put the temple, the residence of your God, up on the high place because it was the symbolic demonstration that that God had supreme authority over everything beneath it. I think I've told you here before, I used to do my sermon walks on the battlefields out in Gettysburg. It was wide open, and I would just walk around there. And through those walks and other things, I learned, you know, sort of the history of the 3 days of battle there. And you can see how much of the battle, it is the story of the hills around town. It's the story of, well, I don't know, Pastor Taylor, you could probably correct me on this, but it's a story of them on one day fighting for the high ground here, fighting for the high ground over there, right? Because the idea is if you have the high ground, well, you're in the position of strength or power or might. Right, so that's the picture here. You put your temple on top of the high ground because there's this symbolic picture that that God is supreme over everything underneath it. Okay, so do you see the sort of the picture that's unfolding here when Micah says in that latter day, the mountain of the house of the Lord, the mountain of God's temple, will be elevated over all other mountains. This is sort of like a polemic against all the other knockoff gods, if you will, of the surrounding nations. Right, Yahweh's mountain, the God of Jacob's hill, will ascend to be the highest. And as a result of that, all the nations will come streaming to it, partly out of respect for his supremacy and authority, but also, you pick it up there, out of esteem, too. Out of this desire to learn of this God, of his character and who he is and what he desires, and to come and to soak in, as it were, his, sort of his wisdom or his intentions. Right? You get the picture there. In a way, they're leaving behind maybe the directives or the laws of the gods that they'd been bowing the knee to, and they're streaming to this hill. And then it has a centripetal? I don't know. Centrifugal? What is it? Centrifugal, you're coming to? Centripetal, you're going out? Come on, where's my science people? I don't know. All right, well, anyway, they're streaming to it, and then the law is going back out. Let me not go in terrain I'm not accustomed to and talk scientific language. But that's the picture. The mountain of the Lord has been elevated over all the other mountains of the other gods. The people are seeing that, and they're inspired by it, such that they come, and they learn the way of this God, and they take that law back out. And that is the unavoidable, or the what you can't separate from this other vision of people beating swords into plowshares and spears into pruning hooks and nations not raging war against others. It's because they've learned the law of the Lord, and that is being put out and practiced now on the ground level. You see that? Okay, so here's where maybe there could be some people here this morning who would, particularly if you're, you know, haven't gone all in on Christianity and you're maybe exploring, checking it out, and you have some questions, or maybe you're a little bit more skeptical or cynical, you might look at this and say, well, wait a second. As I look at the world today, that sort of mentality seems to actually be exactly the problem with so much violence and so much warfare. Isn't it the reason why the world still suffers so much war, so much bloodshed, is because one people group think that their religion is more supreme, more valuable, and more the authoritative source, and they're willing to go to war and to fight for that to make sure that the other people are bowing the knee to their religion. Or maybe, even if you're, you know, thinking even more about it, you might say, yeah, and it's not just a problem out there, but even on our homeland, even in the United States, hasn't the law of God, hasn't at times the Bible been used to justify, I don't know, discrimination, or justify at times subjugation and oppression? Hasn't it been used to justify at times bigotry and hatred? You're going to hear that plenty of times. If you're not thinking that, you're going to hear it from other people. Okay, and to that point, we would say, yeah, point taken. Yes, the world over, religion is often used to justify bloodshed and warfare and violence and oppression. And yes, even here in the United States, yes, the Bible and Christianity has been used to endorse horrible discrimination, subjugation, oppression, slavery at times, going back. So, point taken, right? Valid to have that concern, to have that question. Okay, but so two things in quick response to that. First of all, yes, we would say religion, and yes, even the Bible has been used to endorse and to prop up all sorts of negative behaviors and violence and bloodshed and oppression and all that. Okay, but other things have propped that up too. For instance, fear or vengeance has been used to endorse violence and bloodshed. Land, maybe oil, I don't know. Cotton, spices, you know, going way back. All these have been things to fight over too, and all these have been things to sort of justify subjugation and oppression and violence. As have a whole range of secular ideologies, whether it's neo-Darwinianism or even communism or other things like that. Here's the point. Yes, the Bible can be used to justify oppression and violence, but there's so many other things that people have, so many other tools that people have grabbed onto, fear, you know, anger, you know, all these things to justify their actions of violence and subjugation, all these things. The point being that maybe the issue is not so much the tool that people take to use to prop up and to endorse their efforts of bloodshed and violence. Maybe the issue is more with the people who wield those tools. Or if I can put it another way, maybe it's not the Bible or other religions or oil or land or whatever that make people do violent things. Maybe it's just that we have this inherent tendency towards violence. That people all throughout history have this bent towards subjugation, wrongful uses of power, violence, and oppression. We'll take whatever tools we can get our hands on to prop up our efforts to do so. Maybe it's the case that for men and women, there's a brokenness there such that violence is our default reaction to feelings of fear or insecurity, or violence or anger or infliction of, you know, wrongful uses of power, whatever, is our default reaction to discomfort, or it's our default reaction to when our pride is stamped, or all these things. Maybe the problem, again, is with the wielder of the tool, the wielder of the Bible, than it is the issue itself. Think about that. Be happy to talk more about that with anybody if you have questions about that afterwards. But the other point that I want to put to your attention, this is for all of us, you've got to let this story play out that Micah is laying out here. Actually, you've got to let this story play out throughout the rest of the Bible, this vision of the mountain of the house of the Lord being lifted up and exalted above all the other mountains and hills and all the other gods and religions. In particular, in my mind, I'm thinking today of the book of John, right, as the story continues to unfold. You know, when you come to the first chapter of the book of John, how does he refer to Christ as he's introducing Christ to us? The one full of truth, God in the flesh, who did what? Who tabernacled among us. In numerous places in John, Jesus will be referred to sort of as the new and the ultimate temple. Right? The ultimate display of God in the flesh, of God coming down, taking on flesh, and dwelling and walking amidst his people, right? And then if you keep on going in John, a little bit later on, towards the end of the story, you have Jesus saying something like this to the people: "When I am lifted up, I will draw all men to myself." Right? So here's this picture of the new and the ultimate temple, the new ultimate tabernacle, saying, "And I'm going to be lifted up. And when I am lifted up, I'm going to fulfill this vision of Micah. I'm going to draw all people, all men and women to myself." So here's the question. What's he talking about when he's lifted up? Yeah, he's talking about the cross. He's talking about when he's going to be strung out, nailed to this cross, which is then going to be lifted up on this little hill just outside of town. He's going to talk about this act where he is submitting himself, handing himself over to death, laying down his life, giving his whole life away, so that his people, who are made up of, I don't know, angry folks, bitter, prideful, full of all sorts of violent offenders, that these people might be forgiven of their offenses. Right? He's being lifted up so that the atrocities and the sinfulness and the rebellion of his people, of these people, would ultimately be placed on him, right? So that he would bear the punishment, as Chip talks so eloquently for us up here earlier, so that they wouldn't have to. So they could be forgiven, so that they could be brought into the family. And also, as they're being brought into that family, they might be also begin to experience newness of life. That they would begin to be transformed and remade into the image of Christ. That they would be sort of given new humanity in a way, or being given the life and the freedom to live into. Now, this new way of being human that is being demonstrated for us in Christ. Right, so when Jesus talks about the day when he's going to be lifted up and draw all men to himself, when he talks about the fulfillment, or at least the beginning of the fulfillment of this Micah story, he's not going to some, you know, grand power trip that he's on. Or he's not talking of some egomaniacal effort at acquiring praise and adoration or all these things, right? He's talking about the time when literally the mighty one of all creation, the one who not only created everything but had all things in his hand, willingly emptied himself and gave it all away in love and compassion for the people he came to serve, so that they would be forgiven and being given newness of life. Right? And so you can see that from the Bible's perspective, it's only as we come and we sit at the foot of the cross and you see what's happening on the cross and you learn of that law, and you learn of that, and then you go out and you put that into practice, and you let that stream out, and you take that back out. It's only as that happens, or that's the unavoidable piece to this vision of a day when people are going to take their swords, beat them down, nations won't wage war against them, and war will just be out of the consciousness. It's only as we sit at the foot of the cross and we see the one who had every reason to unleash war and bloodshed on the people spitting on him, but instead chose to give his life away in love and self-sacrifice for that. As we sit under that, learn that, and live that out, that's the piece that makes this vision a little less elusive. Yeah. All right, well, let's ask this question then. So what do we do with that? Because in one sense we say, okay, well, this is an inspiring vision of something that is yet to come, maybe in process now through the work of Christ, and it motivates and inspires us to press on, to keep going through the ups and downs and all that. You know, but here's the other point, that as we said at the beginning, it also is intended to inspire us to increase faithfulness as well, too. Inspire us to actually put into practice, and not wait until that final future day to fully put this law of self-sacrificial love into practice, but to begin to put it into play here now, right? That's what verse 5 is all about. Verse 5 is meant as a response to this vision. It's that the people were responding, okay, I see your vision, Micah. So yeah, all the other peoples walk, each in the name of his own God, but we now will walk in the name of Yahweh our God forever and ever. Yes, now all the other nations still are going after the war and their bloodshed and how they do life and their own story. But we here right now, we're going to put in what we have learned of God and of Christ. We're going to put that into practice now and live that out. Again, if we let this story unfold and develop and you come to Christ and you sit at his feet, maybe we would sit at his feet on another mountain, right? Where he's giving his sermon on the mount to his disciples in the book of Matthew. He's instructing them on who he is and what it means to be a part of his kingdom and live out his kingdom story. And he's saying, you know it, right? He's saying some strange stuff. He's saying, blessed are the poor in spirit. Blessed are the humble, is another way to put it, or those who realize that all that they have, it's not because they're entitled to it or they've earned it, it's all because it's all been given to them by the grace of God. And so blessed are the people who live out of that humility, for theirs is the kingdom. Or blessed are the meek. Blessed are those who have power. Meek is not the same as weak. Meek means blessed are those who have power, but they're not choosing to wield that power exclusively for their self-interest. They have control, or they're able to even let go of that at times as a demonstration of love or self-sacrifice like Christ did. Blessed are those, blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. Blessed are those who hunger for righteousness or mourn. Blessed are the peacemakers. All right, and then he gets into that sermon even more. He says even more sort of outrageous stuff. He says, you know, you have heard it said, love your enemies. I tell you to love, or no, I got that mixed up. You have heard it said, love your neighbors. I tell you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you. Or he says, you have heard it said, eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth. But I tell you, do not refuse those who do evil to you. And if one slaps you in the face or slaps you in the cheek, turn the other cheek. Or if a Roman centurion, one of your oppressors, comes and says, hey, you grab my bag, carry it for a mile for me, take it 2 miles. Or if you're coming to worship and you have a gift to present at the altar and you remember as you come to the altar, hey, my brother has something against me or I have something against my brother, well, pick up your gift and get out of here. Go make it right with your brother before you come in and do this whole worship thing. Right? This is a very different, counterintuitive way of going at life. And then maybe he sums it up in that Sermon on the Mount in a similar way to what we heard last week in Luke. You know, you are salt and light. You are the salt of the earth, a refining agent, and you are the light that shines in the darkness. As the world out there is drowning in the darkness of violence and warfare and bloodshed as the answer to all problems, I'm calling you to be salt and light. I'm calling you to reflect something different. To reflect me and the way of my kingdom, which goes by way of a cross. And maybe we can push that even further a little bit to the ground level and say, well, okay, so how do I think about this? Because I don't have any swords, I don't have any spears, I don't even have a gun in the house or whatever. So what does it look like for me to take this and beat it down into an agricultural instrument? Or I'm not one of the people who is called upon to make decisions of war or is even consulted on that. So I don't have any buy-in here. Yeah, okay, that may be true. But I'm guessing that when you walk out those doors at the end of this hour or whatever, you're going to go back into a world. You're going to go back into families, into neighborhoods. You're going to back to workplaces, roadways, or all sorts of circumstances and environments where your fears and your insecurities are going to be stirred up a little bit at times. All right, you're going to enter into situations where maybe your pride is going to be trampled on just a little bit, or your dignity kind of robbed just a little bit, or maybe you're going to enter into a world where people are going to poke at or take from you some of your comfort that you have longed for, or maybe they're going to, I don't know, maybe you're just not going to be dealt with as fairly or as justly as you think you deserve or what you think is right. So the question is, in those moments when those things come about, what story do you play out? All right, do you play out the stories of the darkened world that says, well, you unleash hell, you unleash warfare and violence and bloodshed to go back and correct all the wrongs that have been done or that you're experiencing? Or you play out the story of Christ and the story of his kingdom, which goes by way of a cross. Right? Do you play out this cruciform life that in the face of hurt, or in the face of wounded pride, or in the face of fear, even an insecurity, are you willing to lay down power? Are you willing to, in the name of love or in compassion, follow the way of the cross and the way of Christ on behalf of those who persecute you or take from you something that was so sacred? See, this is the calling of the church. It's a very sacrificial calling. The church is called to be the people that live as salt and light, that demonstrate the light of Christ to a world that is dying in darkness. The church is called to be the people who are both empowered and set free by the death and resurrection of Christ, and then put on display before a watching world both that death and resurrection and the glorious future that is yet to come. Right? It's the church that is called to display this incredible vision so that the people might see a totally different way to do life, a totally different way to be human, might see who Christ is and what is yet to come, and maybe be stirred or shocked a little bit out of the darkness into what it is God is calling them to in Christ. That's our role. Well, as we wrap it up here, one example that came to mind. I think about this one. I've done a little bit of reading on it. I don't know a whole lot. Maybe Prunella and her family could speak more to it. But, you know, I think of the situation that happened in South Africa, you know, towards the end of the 20th century there, when apartheid was breaking down. And as that old apartheid system with all its discrimination, all of its violence, and everything else that went, injustice that went along with it, as that was beginning to be dismantled and transitioned into what it is now, pretty much I think the whole world over thought that wasn't going to happen with intense bloodshed, either from the people who were trying to hold on to apartheid or from those who had been on the receiving end of so much violence and injustice. Well, now retaliation was going to call for increased bloodshed. So I think pretty much the whole world was expecting that was going to be a bloody moment when that transition took place. Okay, and I don't know exactly how all that played out, but I think by and large, the world was kind of shocked. That's not actually how it played out. There was actually somewhat of a relatively peaceful transition there. And that was led by, in particular, guys like a black bishop named Desmond Tutu, bishop of the Anglican Church down there, who was compelled by who Christ was and was convinced of the power of the gospel, such that he would say, hey, yeah, we got to deal with this. We've got to deal with the hurts and the pain and the violence that's taken place. We need to have those stories told. We need to hear it. We need to feel that. We need to, in a way, make sure that people are cared for in that. But we're not going to buy the storyline that says it's only through violence or vengeance that this all wrong is going to be made right. That even in the midst of this, we can still choose to love and we can still choose to forgive. Initially, it made him an enemy of both sides, right? The people holding on to apartheid didn't like him for that. The people who wanted vengeance in light of all that's taken place, they weren't a big fan of that. But eventually, as he kept talking about it, as he kept demonstrating it, he's a guy with a great big smile. And so as we talk about it with a smile on his face, right, people will begin to see that vision a little bit, and the people supporting it and getting on board with it grew and grew and grew until eventually that became the dominant way. Okay, this is how we're going to deal with this. And yes, the problems were brought to light and the atrocities, we heard it, we felt it, but it didn't go down that similar story. Motivated by this different vision of who Christ was and the power of the gospel, it sort of had this peaceful transition to it. Go read up on it a little bit more. But A.N. Wilson, he's a pretty popular, famous historical writer, biographer, social critic over in Great Britain. And he was a famed atheist for a long time. He wrote a book, I forget what it's called, Why God Is Not Worthy to Be, I don't know, Worthy to Be Followed. But later in life, he actually, his whole commitment to atheism started to crumble a little bit as he saw the emptiness and, as he would describe it, the rational incoherence of the materialistic secular worldview that he was holding on to, and eventually he came to submit his life to Christ. And he's since started writing some things, and he wrote one thing, I guess around Christmas, I don't know what year this was, but he said this: the gospel, would still be true even if no one believed it. The hopeful thing is that where it is tried, where it is imperfectly and hesitantly followed, as it was in Northern Ireland and South Africa during the peace processes, as it is in many a Salvation Army hostel this Christmas, he said, as it flickers in countless unseen Christian lives, here's the thing, it works. And its palpable and remarkable power to transform human life takes us to the position of believing that something very wonderful indeed began with the birth of Christ into the world. That's where this great vision of Micah begins to unfold. And the God of all creation takes on flesh and stoops down to tabernacle and temple among us. And when he had every reason to unleash war and hell upon his aggressors and his oppressors, instead he was lifted up in love. And now he's drawing all people to himself, you and me, his church worldwide, called to learn of him and then to live that out, that law. So how are you doing with that? How are you doing living out the story of the cross, the story of Christ and his kingdom? How are you doing? Which story are you living out? The story of, you know, the use of might and power to defend what I want or what I've accumulated? Or are you living out the story of the cross that says, I'll lay it down in an effort to demonstrate Christ? Which God are you bowing the knee to? These other gods and their laws and their demands? Or this Christ who's been lifted up in the ultimate display of love and self-giving sacrifice? Well, it should always be our prayer that we would see Christ clearly lifted high and that his Spirit would empower us to live free, to live as new people, to live into the image of Christ in that sacrificial, loving way so that the dark and dying world would see it and be shaken and stirred and this vision begin to unfold. And we ask it all in the name of the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit. Amen.